This is season 15. We're all the way up to episode 10, so we're getting very close to the end of this season of Mention and Dispatches. And as we've noted throughout the season, we are leaning a little harder into bringing on different designers for episodes this season. So like last season, we talked about series of games and kind of families of games. This season, we're talking with a bunch of different designers. And so we've had Jim Day. We had the guys from Wargame Design Studio. This time around, we've got our buddies, and we legitimately mean our buddies. We've been friends with these guys for darn near 20 years at this point. Jim Snyder and Rob Crandall from OTS, and the guys behind Flashpoint Germany way back when, but the Flashpoint campaign series now. So, Jim, welcome.
Yep, glad to be here. I'm at least breathing.
This isn't your first podcast with us, but it's your first one in like several years, right?
It's been a while. Yeah, it has been a while.
I think it's been a while. Yeah, and Rob, I think we've had you on a podcast once long, long ago, but it's been a number of years for you as well, right?
It has been a little while. Thank you, Brent, though, for having us again now.
I think we were talking distal stuff with you last time. It's probably how long it's been, so yeah, quite a while. And because he's a guy that knows the series and has like used the series for, you know, teaching and for events and stuff like that, we brought our buddy James Sterrett back to talk some on-target sim stuff as well, and I'm sure James is going to have all sorts of penetrating questions about, you know, what's been going on with on-target sim. So welcome back, James.
Thank you. And I'm required to note that I'm an Army civilian and nothing that I say on this show should be construed as the views of the Army or the U.S. government on anything. And if you try to, you will be mocked.
Yes, yes. And even if you don't try to, you might still be mocked just because that's kind of us.
Sort of equal opportunity mocking.
Yes, yes. We will take every opportunity for mocking. So one of the I want to cover some backstory, but I don't want to bore the audience with backstory because like a lot of the audience have been fans for a while and they know stuff. But On Target Sims has been going for, Rob, you guys have been over 2 decades at this point, right? Or damn close.
It's hitting the 20-year mark. Yes. Yeah. 23, if depending on when you count it.
Okay.
I did a few war games back in the 90s for a company called Simulations Canada.
Yeah.
And we did sort of text-based war games that ran on Apple IIs and Commodore 64s. And they're written in Turbo Pascal and C and things like that.
Yeah,
and long ago. The catalog for that was bought out by Matrix Games almost when they started. And they said, oh, we're going to redevelop some of these games, including three of mine at the time. And I called up the president after a while because they had this amazing forum concept that was revolutionizing wargaming and turning it into a social activity. And so I said, hey, guys, like, what happened to the promise you're going to redo stuff? Long story short, he talked me into redoing stuff, but I didn't want to do mine. So he said, oh, I've got this one called Main Battle Tank. It's set in Germany. It's a hypothetical NATO Warsaw Pact tactical game and had been created to teach young officers kind of the chaos and confusion of the battlefield. So it wasn't a chess game. It was a lot of hidden movement, a lot of fog of war, and a lot of sort of partial C3 so that, you know, you would get partial reports from your subunit saying, I'm under attack. And you might send out an order and it would get corrupted halfway through. And the idea was to demonstrate what they conceived to be the total chaos of a modern battlefield, being, you know, 1989. And so I took that over and I had a complete working war game. I had all the source code sitting on my computer. I said, oh, this is great, but it has to have a graphical user interface and it really needs a lot more scenarios because it had all of four, I think, four nations, four scenarios, four maps. And I go, oh, okay. And then, yeah, the rest, one thing just led to another. And it consistently
it's a whole new game.
It's totally different, yes. And there's no main battle tank code in there, but I still think of that from time to time. I still have it somewhere on my hard drive. And I did it by myself for the first few years, sort of evenings and weekends. And Flashpoint Germany came out in January of like 2005, which was about 2 years later than I wanted. Yeah. And it was good, but just to start. So I'm working on it. And in 2013, like October, the next iteration came out and was Flashpoint Red Storm, still for sale at Matrix. And that's when things started happening. starting with Jim saying, whoever you are, I want to talk to you. Let's be partners. And we met at the Origins Game Fair in Columbus, Ohio, where I was also rendezvousing with James Sterrett, or was about to, but it was all at the same time. And Jim and I hit it off, and we've been working on this thing ever since. We've got like, I don't know, 10 paid people now, and really serious volunteers and contributors and contractors and everything. But yeah, in the early days, it was Jim and I trying to model tactical ground combat in the late 1980s. That was kind of when the Soviet Union started to collapse and battlefield computers were not yet ubiquitous. There was the M1 tanks and the Bradleys were just arriving, so we had a chance. But it wasn't computerized out the wazoo yet. And so we worked on it. We did Red Storm in 2013. We did Southern Storm in 2022. And then speeding things up considerably because we now had more people helping. We got our new game, our new iteration, Cold War, that's coming out this November, November 20th, 2025. Jim, do you remember it that way or have you got a different take on it?
Well, as you're listening to it, the game releases like 2 days if you're listening to the podcast when we first release it. If you're listening to this 3 years later, you missed the boat. Game's been out for a while. So.
You sure that was 2013 that you met with Jim Snyder?
2005. Yeah, we go back to the Flashpoint Germany days is when I hooked up with Rob and Matrix and met everybody at the Origins there because I think that's where we did run into James and Brandt. I want to say Mark Walker, all the crew from Matrix back in the day. So, yeah, as Rob pointed out, we're about 20 years into the making now.
I do remember meeting you guys for the first time at Origins because I'm blanking the guy's name, which is terrible.
David?
Yes. David Heath asked me to talk to you guys. He sent me an email and asked me to talk to you guys. So I came there knowing that this was likely to happen. And I showed up, and this was back in the days when Matrix was still showing up at Origins and making a massive booth. So there was a table that the three of us sat at. And what was, I think, slated originally for sort of a 20, 30-minute conversation took something like 3 to 4 hours. And none of us were complaining about the duration. It was a great chat.
Yeah. Okay, I want to say that describes about 80% of the conversations that I've had in my life with both James and Rob. Jim, I've managed to get out of conversations with fairly quickly. Rob and James, no chance. Like every 20-minute conversation ends up being 2 hours. So that absolutely tracks. I can totally 100% believe this.
Brent, it's the brilliance of your commentary that just we want to draw it out and get more detail and have these transformational life experiences from talking to you.
You realize sucking up to the host only does so much good on the podcast.
Right? I just
this isn't CNN,
back.
Man. I mean, there's only so much I can do for you.
I'll be quiet.
No, don't be quiet. You're the guest on the podcast. I need you to talk. But sucking up is completely optional and, you know, of limited actual value. Look, I think all of us largely have sort of, you know, met and coalesced around stuff at Origins over the years because that was a lot of our primary interaction for things outside of some occasional professional connections here and there. We've all been friends for a long time, never mind just, you know, working on games here and there. So when we talk about dragging these guys onto the show, this wasn't one of those, hi, I'd like to introduce myself as a podcast host and would like to invite you to join us. It was, hey, Jim, Rob, y'all going to show up on the podcast again sometime? All right. So we went from Flashpoint Germany to Flashpoint Campaigns. Obviously, that was a big jump in the way the games, the underlying game functioned and the things, you know, the features that were packed in it. From Flashpoint Campaigns, the first one to the second one, from Red Storm to Southern Storm, it was, I think that one was more evolutionary. Our jump from Southern Storm to Cold War to the new one, how much new stuff have we crammed under the hood? What's the selling point here? What's the big shtick, the big payoff that people are expecting out of the new one? Rob, sell some games here, man.
Thank you, Brent. The big new thing is helicopter-borne air assault. The Soviets at the time, Warsaw Pact forces, had a number of air assault battalions and brigades, and they meant to hop the front line and drop in the rear, you know, seizing bridges and key points. And there were a great deal of talk. All of the books talk about it that were written at that time, but we couldn't model it in the game. And so we said, look, it's time to get serious. We need to do this. And that's the biggest single thing now. There's a whole new game mechanic for doing that. And if you have if you're playing a game where the other side can do that, you look at the map now completely differently, because those assault forces are so darn fast. They can get in, you'll just get a glimpse, and then they're there. And then you have to react to, you know, a chokehold deep in your rear. They'll sit on a bridge you absolutely have to have or something like that. I should mention this is a tactical war game, ground combat, high intensity. It assumes that the Cold War went hot, as they say, in July of 1989, and that the Warsaw Pact is attacking all across the inter-German border. With Southern Storm, the previous game, we had the same premise, but we looked mostly at the southern third of the entire front. So that was U.S. 7th Corps and the West German 3rd Corps. And that has a lot of really interesting terrain, low unit densities, and so it presents a lot of tactical challenges. What we were going to do after that was release DLCs, sort of one per NATO corps as you head further north. And so the next one would have been U.S. 5th Corps and the Belgium 1st Corps. And Matrix said, yeah, you could do that, but we'd be happier if you just, you know, did the greatest hits of the whole thing, the whole front. Like, we want to see full the gap. And, you know, you're starting to do that. But we want to see the British Army. We want to see stuff further up north as well. And so we looked at it and said, yeah, you know, that would more work. But it's it gives us a lot more freedom, too, our artistic freedom. And we don't have to do things that, oh, because, you know, it's their turn now. We have to do this. And we just go straight for the good stuff. So you've got meaningful employment of a much wider number of nations. You've got twice the scenarios and campaigns that we had before. It's very content rich. And it's got the new air assault. There are a host of other changes. A lot of the game we rewrote over the last 3 years to deepen the modeling. This is something just a concept I learned from James Sterrett, actually. When you're doing a game, you have to pick and choose what you're going to model in detail and what you're going to abstract out. You can't model everything. There's not enough hours in recorded history to do that. But you pick the things that are important and then have this concept of selective fidelity. So if something really matters to you, you model it properly. Otherwise, okay, design for effect. Like, just get us in the ballpark, but don't bog down the players. And so we did a lot more modeling and deepening the models that we were using almost across the board. You know, everything from the AI to the movement to the firing game mechanics. A second goal, though, and this was a separate partner in our team, he said that the game has to be playable and ideally no more complicated than Red Storm was. And so even though we've deepened things and given you lots of bells and whistles and you can dig into the selective fidelity part, you don't have to, especially when you're just starting. If you can run a Windows program, you can point and click and call up menus in this and run this game. You may not win. It's easy to learn, but hard to master, I would say, but it's there. And just a couple other points, if I may. The game has full fog of war, although as a beginner, you can turn that off and you can see where all the enemy units are and what they're up to. But once you turn that off, it's a very tense, immersive game. And for those of us who play it with a lot of planning up front, you know, we're working on what's up the worst course of action the enemy could take here? Kind of what's my best course of action? What's their best course? You start to think and you start to look at the map in a new way. And we have a host of tools for visualizing the lay of the land and what the ranges are and, you know, what's hidden and what's not should they come into view. If they're coming down this road, not that road. Oh, okay. You know, you can set up the recon battle to find that out early. Plan accordingly. But you don't have to. You can just keep it simple. It's been a long day. You know, you've got 40 minutes and then you have to, you know, go to bed. Okay, you can play this too and you can just have fun just doing it. Get involved with the details later if that's what grabs you. Yeah. Jim, what would you say?
We've got, it's the improvements, I think, from some of the lessons learned out of Southern Storm. So better command and control graphics, cleaning up on some of the delay loops. There were definite issues in Southern Storm where certain functions and commands would take longer than they should have. And some things were a little too responsive. Artillery, for one, the loop on spotting to going up the FSCC fire chain to rounds on target was a little too quick and for what it was doing. So we've kind of backed stuff back down into more realistic numbers. We didn't have illumination rounds in Southern, and that was something the Warsaw Pact players wanted to definitely kind of even the odds against thermal sights in the night battles. So we've got working illumination now. And really what Rob pointed out, there's new features, but we pretty much touched everything under the hood over the last few years to go in, make the sensors work better, the AI perform better, a lot of work put into the SOPs, the standard operating procedures, especially to help new players. We've got presets for SOPs. So now you can say, okay, I want to move a tank unit. I can go look at tank specific SOPs and kind of match that up to my mission. And we've done a lot of work to make sure those presets will get you a decent outcome for a beginning player. And then as you learn certain things and learn key elements of those SOPs, you can go in and fine tune them. And like Rob said, you can start really digging down deeper and deeper, as deep as you want to go into some of this stuff, you know, setting things up. Now, some people have always wanted, well, I want to be able to tell this unit to only shoot this type of person at this distance. Are we going to give the player that? No. You know, you're not in the tank. You know, you're not the infantry squad on the ground. You've given them a basic orders and a basic, you know, stance on how to carry things out. And that's kind of what we want. You know, the little pixel troops, they've got to do their thing, but they're going to make mistakes. They're going to get pushed and fall back. They're going to surrender at times. You know, it's the battlefield. And you as the commander, you've got to play that lead role. And yes, you do kind of push down a little bit into the lower levels by setting where things go and how they act. But again, you're not driving the tank. You're not shooting the gun. And I think that's where the game kind of really excels in putting you in that commander role.
It's one of the things I really like about the system is the fact that you, particularly given that you've got small units on the field that you're ordering around, but you've got, relative to those, you've got immensely long turn times, which means that you really have to think in terms of what is their mission? Where are they supposed to go? Generally, what are they supposed to do? And as you said, you know, give them the parameters of the order, and then you're stuck while it runs through the next 15, 20, 30 minutes.
Right. And it puts some criticality. Well,
hold on. I want to clarify something. When you're saying the next 15, 20, 30 minutes, you're talking about game time, not real time.
Correct.
Right. Well, yeah. I just want to make sure that, you know, the audience that may not be familiar with it isn't thinking, oh, shit, I got to sit there and watch the screen for 30 minutes. Like, that's not what we're talking about.
So being even more clear, many, particularly if you're on the NATO side, the, you know, the U.S. blue, whatever you want to call it side, the units you're ordering around are typically platoons, which are fairly small for running through a 20-minute turn. You could give them an order and they're out of contact at the beginning, and conceivably they could be destroyed before you next get a chance to influence the game by putting in an order. But that, as I said, that forces you to think ahead.
Yeah. You do have to think. And it also brings into light that command delay and the command cycle times for both sides. It's the famous OODA loop. You know, you observe, you orient, you decide, then you act. And the whole idea is, as long as you can keep your command cycle time short and work on making the other guy's time get large, you can start acting inside of their command cycle. So if I can do two or three things while he's only doing one, it becomes a powerful advantage on the battlefield. You know, it makes my one platoon that much stronger against a company of the enemy when I can adjust them two or three times, and he can't.
One of the things I was going to ping you with today is, where did that model come from? When did you introduce it? How did you develop it? How's it changed over time?
I'll throw that to Rob.
Yeah, the entire OODA loop thing. When I first started researching the game, because I was not a modern war or what would now be Cold War guy at the time. It was World War II. But I'm looking, I bought John, or was it Colonel John Boyd, Major John, who came up with the concept and publicized it. And then somebody, Lind, wrote a book called Maneuver Warfare, which was very much based on that. And so this was the kind of theory that was circulating at the time to support the whole fight outnumbered and win premise that we had. And right from the start, I mentioned that I got the code from Main Battle Tank, and it had a game event rail, sort of a programming construct in it, where you just drop events into a queue and then they go through in turn as time progresses. And I was looking at it going, you know, we could have not just the orders phase, but a separate orders phase for each side, should we want to. And that might be a way to kind of put in this OODA loop, this Boyd cycle concept, which then would allow the Blue Forces, NATO, to be outnumbered 3-1, but still be contenders in some sort of battle that we're trying to pull here. And so really that was almost a day one thing. You know, that was, if sort of allowed as a starting designer, 3-5 big things that you want to really kind of illustrate and focus on in your game. The OODA loop was one. Another one was just the different movement factors and qualities. You know, you can have tanks and infantry all moving down a road, but if they move at different speeds, you get a mess. Everything turns into a traffic jam. And synchronizing the movement of troops on a modern battlefield is not easy. It's a distinct challenge, I believe. And then you have airstrikes and artillery fire, and you have to start keeping track of everything. And so just the difficulty of getting moving troops to go where you want them to and static troops to get moving was a thing I wanted to show. Something else that came along later was meaningful staff reports. And I got this from the Origins crowd where James ran an exercise using early versions of the game. And a lot of ex-military guys would be playing and they'd be sort of role-playing staff officers all on the same side. And they'd look at the game. We had maps spread out. They were supposed to play from the maps, but a computer screen that dominated, Brant's whole area would be up, and we'd be some like the Intel side and everything would be watching that. And I wasn't looking at the screen. I was looking at their faces. I was going, are they understanding? Are they seeing the important things? It was user testing and extremely valuable to see what they got and what they didn't. And then we'd go home and start writing, do a report that shows, so the current situation report. And if we show another one that shows like the vehicle silhouettes in a report of the enemy. And we have an intelligence map where we draw goose eggs and things. And we say, this is where we think the enemy is. And these are the spotting reports that we've got so far. So you can say, the tanks are here and these telltale recon vehicles are over here. And so you're not kind of playing a real-time strategy game. You're thinking, you're looking, you're going, I know I saw a recon unit over on that right edge, but where? Well, there's a report that tells you. And all of that kind of comes together. So you can form sort of an operational concept of what's happening. And really with almost minimal clues, I would say, in the early stages of the game, with full fog of war, you're starting to pick out, you're expecting them to come down maybe three different high-speed corridors. And so you position some units accordingly. And bingo, you start getting glimpses of the enemy at a sufficient range that you can then do something with these orders that take 15 or 20 minutes to implement. And get your guys in the right position to defend in time. Or if you're playing them from the other side, to bypass them, get around them in time. So it creates a tremendous immersion factor, an engagement factor. And I know every game claims that, but we have people telling us, it was so absorbing. One more turn, the classic one more turn thing.
Yeah.
We've tried very hard to keep that and not mess that up.
And that's the Holy Grail, is the one more turn thing.
Mm.
James, it almost sounds like they were paying attention when I was given the talks about, here's how to do your intel analysis, your IPB, and most dangerous versus, most likely courses of action. I've got a couple of questions. One I'm going to save for a little later, but the one I want to ask now, just because it's something that is cued off of what you were saying, as I'm sitting down playing and I've developed my intel estimate and I'm expecting to see certain things show up in certain places that are going to confirm or deny one way or the other what enemy course of action I'm looking at and allow me to take that threat template and expand it across, to use that threat template to be predictive of where I think other parts of the formation are going to show up or give me some sense as to what the enemy's likely objective is. All of those things you expect a tactical intel guy to be doing for you. When I'm a solo player against the AI, I think there's a reasonable expectation that you guys have built the AI, whether the AI is red or blue, is east or west, you can build in the expected doctrinal behavior. But if I'm playing head to head, one of the biggest criticisms for folks that are looking for those kinds of doctrinal cues within a war game, one of the biggest criticisms head to head is those doctrinal cues don't exist because your opponent is not bound by them. If I'm playing head to head in a game like this, what, if any, kinds of constraints do you put on players or incentives do you give to the players to adhere to a particular type of doctrine such that those intel tools are still of value to me?
Let me try that, and then Jim can correct my errors. We'd mentioned standard operating procedures, SOPs, and there's a lengthier list than ever of ways to express your commander's intent prior to any kind of engagement happening. And a lot of the SOPs were aimed at kind of allowing you to embed what I call national characteristics. It's like the West Germans had a very particular style. The British had a very contrasting style. Americans were kind of in the middle, just for a lot of things like engagement ranges. How toughly do you fight for the ground and how quickly do you give it up without regret to go move somewhere else and get them somewhere else? It's a long list of things. And so we have that to shape things at the national level. And we probably could do more, but what we have is already, very complex if you start to dive into it too much. We then created a system of battle plans. And I believe that was in Southern Storm, but certainly it's a key part of this. And you can set up the battle plans to reflect national doctrine a bit better. So the Soviets will enter the field of battle in approximately the correct order and with the correct timings between the combat patrol and the forward escort and all that, security elements. And so that helps a lot. Basically, though, I would say that we wanted the game to certainly be playable by professionals the way that they've been taught. But there are so many different nations. It's very hard to hardwire in, say, just one nation's doctrine or one nation's method of war and have it apply to everybody. If we could, we would have, but we just couldn't. So, yes, civilians can play it any way they like. One of the best compliments we had was from a Warsaw Pact, a former Warsaw Pact officer. He got, I think it was Red Storm, actually. He said, I played Red. I played it according to our tactical principles, and I won. I love the game. He was expecting some Hollywood fluff or something like that. But yeah, so players do it. And professional users will have house rules. I guess that's what it comes down to for us, is they'll go, yeah, the game might let you do this, but we're not going to let you. You have to fight according to our precepts and follow our own mission standards. And for the U.S., that's the military decision-making process. You have to show evidence of that. And in their case, if you're talking professionals, it's not if they win or lose. It's how well they follow doctrine and their precepts and the proper stages of planning. And, you did X. Why did you do that? Like justify doing X to us. And, it was by the book. Or I knew from a previous example that this was like more likely to work than the book answer. Something like that. But it's not just, just blow things up. It's no, show us you've learned something. Show us you've learned some of your training. And so it comes out more at that human level than at the game mechanics level. What would you say, Jim?
This becomes it's a tough call. You really can't do a whole lot to stop human on human players from doing, I'll say, non-doctrinal/crazy things. It's just the nature of human players when you get into that kind of player versus player environment. I don't know, you don't want to artificially clamp down on players because one, you'd have to waste a whole lot of time trying to put in rules and some kind of mechanics within the computer code itself of, that player is doing something stupid. We can't allow it, because that'll just piss the player-on-player people off. So you don't, you just leave that out of the game. It would be great at some point if you could, have players play it the way it was intended, but I don't see a way to do it that way. And to Rob's point, when you're dealing with military people using it for military application, they're going to follow, the correct steps. They're going to do the doctrine. It gives them freedom to try things out, which is what you kind of want with a game like this. Let's rewind the clock and let's go south instead of north. What happens in this situation? And if you're providing that kind of openness, it's inherently going to bring with it the fact that a player-on-player world can get a little crazy. It's just the nature of the beast.
As a side note, one of the things I'm moderately allergic to is straitjacket and play stupid rules, because it doesn't, Jim was just talking about the need for people to experiment and try things, and you learn things from the experimentation. And if the game is built well, which, let's face it, Flashpoint is, then you are likely to get rewarded for doing things the way the force is designed to work, and you are likely to get punished for doing things that it's not designed to do. And therefore, you get a much deeper learning and a much better understanding than if you're simply told, you must do this and the game will forbid you from doing something else.
Yes.
I guess one potential way around that would be not necessarily to explicitly forbid something, but maybe to incentivize doing the smart thing, right? If you follow the doctrine, you get XYZ bonuses, or you get some sort of improvement, or maybe things happen faster because that's the way your guys are trained to operate. And so that OODA loop accelerates a little bit. As opposed, so you get a bonus for doing something within those doctrinal constraints, as opposed to not getting it if you just go off the reservation and just go hog wild. I mean, that's a way. That may not be the best way, but it's a potential way to do it where you avoid what Snyder was talking about, which is pissing people off because you don't let them do crazy stuff, but you don't reward the crazy stuff.
And yes, and often, in particular, getting people to do something in a game that is dumb, you need to put in a reward for them to do it. So if you're trying to recreate a historical situation in which the historical people did something that in retrospect was really not smart, but you need to incentivize the players to do the thing that is not smart with the hope of win the game or decisive victory or something if they overextend just too much and then they know that they're taking the risk. But in an ideal situation, in a perfect world, the reward and punishment falls out of the system without the need for additional things. And in a scenario-based game like Flashpoint, then you probably can't include, hey, you'll win if you just push this little eats harder and sticking your neck out, because it's hard to apply that to every single scenario.
I was just going to make that comment that James has it right. If the game, or in this case, if our game is doing things right, and you use the correct doctrine and you use the correct equipment in the correct way, that should on its own provide the correct outcome. Grant, what I was going to say, you bring up an interesting point, but my response was going to be, well, how do you set left and right limits? Because every scenario is different. Every case of equipment on the map would be different. You kind of run yourself in circles pretty quick that, how much is too much? How much is an incentive? And I think you've got to let the mechanics of the system provide the result.
Yeah. Hey, look, if I knew the answer to that question, then you guys would have hired me by now.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. We'd all be on every game magazine,
I mean, yeah. So, look, I'm a podcast host. I'm not supposed to provide solutions. I'm supposed to ask the questions from you guys, right?
It's a good question, but I think I go with the James answer, which is if the system is doing things correctly, you kind of get that outcome 9 out of 10 times. The crazy guy is going to get stomped, and the guy who followed doctrine, he used the equipment. And I'll say, to be honest, in these games, up to the point of Cold War with its tactical transport, one of the reasons why we didn't separate troops from their carriers by much distance was to get rid of some of the gamier issues where players will then run one or the other thing around, to use it as a collector for victory points, out of its, doctrinal stance. So, that's kind of one way we control some of that. But it's tough to really do a lot of it. And there are things coming that we'll be working on into next year for some of the other games that'll hopefully backfit, where we can take some of the other issues off the table with, I played this scenario 10 times. I know exactly when and where the other side's reinforcements are coming. So, stop the basic spawn camp sniping of things. There's ways we're going to work around some of that and fix it.
If I could just add in just one last pylon to this big pylon. James has a colleague, Mike Dunn, and he came to Origins 1 year. And we were talking, and Mike has played a host of games. He's designed games. He says whenever he sits down to play a game, he uses good military tactics. He does not go for gaming exploits at all. He just uses good tactics. And that was a transformational experience for me, because I just assumed players wouldn't ever use gamey tactics, like just cutthroat to win. Like, what? That's not what this is about. But then I looked at it again, and in our core group of 6 people, 3 of us had prior military experience, and they were very sensitive to this issue and said, no, that's a gamey tactic. And so no harsher condemnation than that. And we'd say, okay, well, how do we model it properly then? And so we go into that selective fidelity thing and expand it in that area so it's not properly modeled. And that's kind of a touchstone for us. Good military tactics should beat bad military tactics. And we feel that, broadly speaking, they do in this game. It took a lot of work, but it shows.
Yeah, there's always a should component to these things, right? Should is everybody's favorite word around these things. So, yeah.
And people have wildly different ideas on what it should be. And just as we come into the release phase, I'm getting some pretty interesting commentary from, people saying, oh, you should have done Major Rivers completely differently in your game. And I'm going, you're telling me this now, 20 years in. But You get that ferment of ideas. You're always got sort of opposing viewpoints and new perspectives. And you have to go back to your core assumptions again and say, why was I doing it the way I was? Maybe they're right.
Season 15 of Mentioned in Dispatches is graciously supported by all of our Patreon members, but especially our regimental patrons who supported us at the top level. The Armchair Dragoons would like to thank Miles R., James M., Kevin Bertram, Catastrophe Games, Fred and his dog, Joseph Knorr, Patrick Geraghty, Michael Sunborg, Stagger Wing, and Paul LaFontaine. Wargaming is our jam, and they help us spread it. You too can support the Regiment of Strategy Gaming as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
Jim will smile because during a long period during the Red Storm years, we had a lot of people write to us saying, I was in the Army then, and you know, I was in this unit. I think you can improve your game by doing X. One guy, for example, artillery, gave us a brilliant 2-page summary of how scatterable mines, FASCAM, works in real life.
Yep.
And we use that. That's fantastic. And we ended up calling the whole thing the Player's Edition by the end of it, because we'd gotten so many good ideas from the people who bought and played it, who had, you know, good knowledge. It's not that everyone had good knowledge, or if they were in the service, you know, had a good idea. But boy, did we get a lot of good stuff from the players of our games.
Hey, look, having spent, you know, plenty of time in the service, I can tell you there are some absolute batshit crazy people whose ideas you should never listen to. Like, those guys exist. The problem is weeding them out, right? That's your challenge.
And that is a challenge because, you know, I think the highest form of we must be on the right track is when you get people from both sides of the curtain telling you that you're biased, you know, on both sides of the curtain.
Yeah, that's always fun. So, James, I had another question that's likely to send these guys off into a spiral, but before I did that to him, I wanted to let you jump in here if you had something else you wanted to go with.
So I'm putting in a pause deliberately in case this is a question you don't want. Can you talk about how the work that you've done on the modern version of Flashpoint campaigns for the Marine Corps has altered or shifted or directed what you've done in the new civilian release?
I certainly can. We did some work over a period of years for Marine Corps University. And being Marines and, you know, assaulting heavily defended islands across beaches, they wanted amphibious assault in the game. They were making their own maps and their own, you know, data files, units. And they wanted to be able to have an amphibious assault capability. And so we created it. And while we were at it, we said, well, it's not just amphibious. It's also heliborne air assault. And it's also truck convoys. You can have like just ground transport. It's because you have separate passenger and transport units marrying up, doing a mission, splitting up again. And that was an enormous amount of work. But thanks to the Marine Corps University, we were able to do it. And they have that sort of thing now for their headline tournaments, or will soon, I guess. They did other things as well. But I would say that the focus on that really was a big thing that moved the needle a lot for us.
Are you able to talk about what I'm really driving at is, have you done things that make it really modern war, or was that not in the Marine Corps, the current version? Yeah, if that's a question.
I would say it did not make it modern war per se, but we've hooked up with a different design group who shall remain nameless for the moment, but there will be a modern war Flashpoint in our future someday. And these are our, you know, professionals. And they say, okay, here are the things the game really needs. And so we have a short list of three that will make it much more modern war friendly. It's a bit like building a house and then saying, oh, can you make it a three-story house? You just lift up the two stories you've gotten out of basement or a main floor. Oh, let's lift it up and let's add five more stories. You're like, well, if I'd known what you wanted to start with, I would have built the foundation out. We have to make huge data model changes to accommodate these things. But yeah, we've never been more excited about what we're working on. This is not the time to talk about all that, but hopefully Brent will invite us back when it is time. We'll tell you all about the modern war stuff.
And there's sort of a somewhat unfair knock-on question. When I'm in the oral exam stage with my master's students, I will also often ask them to redesign their game for something somewhat out of the ordinary, outside its primary thing. So how would you use the engine you've got, or what would you change in order to model Napoleonic warfare, tactical warfare?
Oh, that would be so much fun and so much easier. We have a guy that really wants to do World War II just because it's so much easier. A lot of our design is data-driven, so that Jim's spreadsheets have all kinds of stuff that we would simply take out if we were doing a Napoleonic. We'd have very simple, you know, types of units. The game scale, 500 meters a hex, I'm not, you know, we'd have to figure it out. But yeah, we could do that and probably put more emphasis on sort of transmission of orders on horseback. So it really does take, you know, a while for your, you send out a pair of couriers. It really does take them 15 or 20 minutes to get where they're going and connect with the right person. So we'd want to model that in more detail. But beyond that, it's mostly stuff we would take out and just have simpler, easier lives. Would you say that, Jim?
I'd say yes, there's some of that. Now, of course, some of the additional modeling of what exists time frame would have to tighten up. Yeah, we go from where small arms, you know, rifles, pistols, and some of the cannons are kind of on the low end scale and kind of abstracted to, you know, they now become the tank guns, you know, of our setup. So they would be modeled a lot tighter. You'd have to pick up the fidelity on that. And we've had discussions in this area of what we would like to do with a Kriegsspiel model. And I think the biggest amount of work for us would be is you need that kind of mini-on-mini player capability for that. The ability to start up a game and be in command of your group of troops and have other people commanding your, you know, blue side, red side, and have it, you know, communications flowing with the delays Rob's talking about to get the full, you know, chaos of it. And then maybe, you know, throw some spectator modes in there so people can watch the chaos unfold. That would be the biggest lift, I think. Yeah, easy to strip a bunch of stuff out. I don't have to worry about thermal sights and
air power
and helicopters, ships and you know, things like that.
Electronic warfare.
Yeah, a lot of stuff goes away.
Mass destruction. But,
All right, let's be honest. Primary thing you would need for a Napoleonic version is square buttons.
Yes.
Well, Jim Ozarski could tell us which buttons should be square, I'm sure.
Yes.
So would you need to model blue on blue, fog of war against blue? My inability to see what I can't personally see from my horse.
All right, you just stole my question. That's where I was going to go.
You're welcome.
Perfect. No, that is a very valid question, though, that I wanted to ask about is you guys talk about the fog of war model of, hey, what's the bad guy trying to do and how do I find out? But modeling your own fog of war that I'm not 100% sure where my dudes are and what they are doing. And everybody picks up the moron lieutenant at Central Issue Facility, right? Every unit's got one. It's on their hand receipt somewhere. And so, like, you know, how do you account for those guys?
Yeah, I think we'd actually extend the engine quite easily for blue and blue fog of war, because we spend a lot of time working out line of sights, and there is a unit that represents you, the Supreme Commander, on the map. And so, yeah, we could put in a layer that say, yeah, if you don't have eyes on, you only get an approximate indicator. Oh, you know, we think that Durlan's Corps is over here, but, you know, we can't actually be sure of that.
So when I'm over here and I get a message from Brandt talking about what he's doing at the other half of the map, the other corner of the map, how do I represent what I think I know?
We have lots of reports. And so you simply go through and see, you know, they're all timestamped. You say, the latest I heard from Brandt over there was, you know, an hour and a half ago. And this is what he said he was doing. And that's my information. I want to make this game. Yeah, Jim, can we stop what we're doing and do this instead?
Well, there's some of this, you know, talking about friendly fog of war. Yeah, you know, we've had these discussions probably over the last few years within the team on, you know, just exactly where is the break of that between a commercial product that people will enjoy, I'll put the air quotes, fun, you know, versus what's realistic that needs to be out on the modern battlefield for, you know, hey, there's a jammer and I've just lost, you know, C Company on the net. Yeah, so in our game terms, when you're looking at the map, you know, there should be a set of counters on the map, but they're stuck there because that's the last time you knew exactly where they were, or maybe they fade over time until there's a new report. Same thing could be with if there's combat, instead of being fairly specific about unit losses, you know, now it's, you know, hidden till later, or, you know, over or underreported. So we get the famous, you know, hey, they killed 8 of the 4 SAMs that are out there type of reporting. I still love that to this day, James. That was a beautiful, beautiful thing.
We've got that on video.
I know. It's good to start. But yeah, it things that if the professional customer comes and says, look, I really need this blue on blue friction, it would be something we would add in and figure out how to dilute it down into the player game for commercial side. It's just, you know, where does fun meet reality for people? And granted, it could be an option you turn on and off. But it's there, and you would definitely need it if you go to basically back in time. So World War II or into, you know, Napoleonics, it becomes a bigger piece and a more realistic piece that would have to be there. You know, 80s up to now, modern times, other than dedicated EW and jamming and some spoofing activities, a little tougher to lose track of people on the modern battlefield. Not impossible.
Let's go! As we start to, you know, get a little closer towards the end of the conversation here, the whole idea of the modern battlefield is one that I'm definitely interested in. And I think all of you have heard this at various times over the years, and certainly the audience has as well. And again, you know, with us all knowing each other for damn near two decades now, my argument has only gotten more, more on point as the years have gone by. But in, you know, the original game, set in 88-ish, right? 40 years before that, you were talking the Korean War with almost World War II-like forces at the start of that conflict. Roll forward 40 years to get us to where we are now. And people see M1 tanks from the 1980s, they see M1 tanks now, and they go, oh, it's the same game, when clearly it's not. I mean, there's been a lot that has changed over the last 40 years, that it's not just, oh, M1 tanks then, M1 tanks now, we're doing the same thing. This has been, you know, sort of a personal crusade of Brandt's over the last few years, that modern today is not the same thing as what we're looking at from Cold War Goes Hot. That said, over the last 3 or 4 years, there have been even way more changes than there probably were in the 35 years in between, with some of the very real world lessons we're seeing on the battlefield somewhere like Ukraine right now. Are you guys, as you're spinning forward towards something modern, how easy or hard is it to now incorporate drone warfare, to incorporate the use of targeting civilian technologies, right? Every troops running around the front with a cell phone, but those now give off signatures that are potentially targetable. You know, the idea of varying levels of morale and troop quality, depending on whether these are like penal battalions literally recruited out of prisons, or African mercenaries hired on the cheap to, you know, throw on a Russian uniform and go attack. Like, how much work are we looking at to make this truly, like, air quotes, modern versus, you know, Cold War Goes Hot from 40 years ago?
You kind of answered the question yourself. It's a large gap, and it's evolving. And I think part of the trick is, you know, how you frame the current activities and the intensity of those activities as to, let's say, you know, if it becomes a NATO-Russian type of deal, what's the intensity level? You know, right now things are, I will say, amazingly slow in the Ukraine. You know, it's not a Cold War gone hot type of thing. You know, you're not clashing, you know, hundreds of tanks and aircraft. You know, we throw a couple things here, a couple things there. You know, there may be movements of troops that are fairly sizable, but then it slows down and becomes, you know, pretty much a trench warfare fight with pretty much drones everywhere. You know, some of the shots you see of all the fiber optics glistening off the fields is insane. Roads covered with nets to keep the FPV drones off of them. Tanks that look like they're basically moving, almost moving forts of the, 1800s with the sticks and spikes and nets, and yeah, God knows how they see out of them, and I guess they don't. It's weird, and we're having to deal with a lot of that. We definitely have to improve a number of models, and we are going to expand on our models to cover drone warfare across all its phases, and that's everything from something that, you know, Joe Soldier throws up in the air to, you know, overhead, high altitude, long endurance. And the other piece of the puzzle that you kind of skipped over in your discussion of it is just the range of strike now. You know, in the 80s, when you look at an MLRS and think, oh, that's a pretty good stick at 100 kilometers or whatever, it's nothing now. Precision strikes at, you know, 3,000-5,000 kilometers, which can be vectored in pretty much instantly from some drone on a battlefield. You know, we've got to take into account, you know, weapon time, weapon overflight, positions of these off-map assets, and how they affect the tactical battlefield. All that is in the stuff Rob says, you know, we're working on, and it's going to be the big pieces that modern brings to the table.
Ooh. One of the other things that, of course, lots of folks ask about, and I'm curious how this has evolved some over the years. One of the things that we've known is, hey, if you need to make a change to something, call Snyder, because he's the guy that's dealing with the database. So if we've got something we want to change, call him. And how much, if at all, does your average user have the ability to potentially mod the game if they wanted to change the lethality of a tank or they wanted to change the identity of the unit? Is there much of a mod interface built in for people to make changes to it? Or is that something you guys have kept pretty tightly locked down?
Rob, you want to jump on that, or...
What you're describing, Brant, is the perfect way to cheat. So we have extensive modding capabilities, but the scenarios that we ship are locked down, to a degree. All the data that's stored for a nation, you know, Canada, U.S., is in a locked Excel file. But you can create your own file and make your own stuff with that. It's not that hard to start hacking into it, and we actually are highly interested in people doing that. Jim has written extensive documentation on all of that, but we stop short of enabling it for somebody playing a play-by-email game to hack his data so that he automatically wins. We draw the line there.
That's probably the sporting thing to do.
Yeah, I'll make one clarification there. The data files themselves, they're not locked. You know, we did that way back in Red Storm. Wasn't a great idea. What Rob's pointing to is the scenarios themselves have the data from the game that we produced baked in. Now, you can always make a new version of it, of a scenario with your altered data, but it's going to have to be called something else or it's going to conflict with what we've done. That way you keep people from cheating the system. Now, can people find ways around everything? Of course. But, you know, when you pick your opponents, pick well. That's all I can really say. We go back to the earlier discussion of, you know, some people want to win and they want to win at all costs. So they're going to have their M1 tank with, you know, 75 feet of armor and 20 guns on it and, you know, lasers and whatever else. But it's an open system. You know, you can go crazy. You can go in. We've got documentation. You can do, you know, modified data. You can build your own. There's people that have been doing that since the Red Storm days. There's Southern Storm folks doing it. The professional folks have done it for their stuff. So it is approachable. You know, you can do your own scenarios. The only piece of the puzzle, and people yell about it, is maps. There's not really a simple map making tool. There, we've got documentation on how to approach it to make your own. And we've had major discussions about it, but there's a lot baked into the way we do our maps to make them as realistic to the ground as a hex grid can get. So it's not the good old days of, you know, throw in a quick and dirty tile map editor and away you go. We're just not that.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. I know that for some game series, the ability to mod things is a big deal. The Harpoon community has been modding things for 30 years. For other games, they are very tightly locked down and know you're going to play the game we designed, damn it. You know, and so.
I'm a modder by trade. That's where I started eons ago on my Commodore. So, you know, we're very, very mod friendly. I mean, you want to change a badge, change it, a flag, go for it. You know, you want different silhouettes, colored silhouettes, add them in. You want to change the sound effects, go for it. The data is there. There's a lot of stuff exposed that allows you to kind of, you know, do your own thing. Now, the good thing with Cold War is we've brought a lot more nations to the table, a lot more equipment to the table, a lot of art, a lot of NATO symbols, you name it. There's a ton of stuff coming with this already. So you've got a great ground to start on.
So if I'm playing the Belgians in the new Cold War game, like, how much freedom of maneuver do I really have, given that, one, they ain't that many of them, and two, like, there's a whole bunch of Americans and Germans and Brits in the way that, like, I'm going to be tripping over if I try to, you know, go all Leroy Jenkins as the Belgians out there. Like, how much, if I'm the Danes, if I'm, you know, Luxembourg, like, how much of what do I really have to work with as a part of these things, or is it very scenario dependent?
It's very scenario dependent. Which area you're fighting in, what the type of fight is. There's definitely a number of multinational scenarios. The Belgians are definitely in there. You've got the French in there. Luxembourg, not yet. You'll have to wait for the next iteration to get them with the Dutch and the Danes and some of the other folks up north.
What do you call the next one? Colder War?
You know, technically speaking, since we're going north, north. Yeah, that could be that the tide will work on that. It'll make it tough when we go south. I don't have a warmer war, but we'll figure it out.
Less Cold War.
Less Cold War.
Yeah. Trademark it now.
Falling war.
Yeah. War in Greece.
James, what else you got for these guys? James is still on mute.
Yeah, James is thinking. Sorry.
We've hit all the key things you wanted to hit, huh?
We have. But one thing that was sort of lurking in the background. Do you guys have a favorite scenario?
Ooh. I do not. But that's just me. When I put the game up, I'm examining it for faults. And I don't play to enjoy anymore. I just go, okay, too simple. It needs more variety. It needs this, that, bang. Or I'm just testing like the air assault part of it. I like low density scenarios. So like the ones from the very beginning of the war. You can now sort the scenarios by their start date. So you can say, top of the list, here are the ones at the beginning of this war. And A Time to Dance is in there. And that's got a really low unit count. And I really enjoy the purity of that. Every unit you've got counts, and you don't have enough, so you have to make decisions, and you have dilemmas. And the red battle plans are quite different. So you can't count on, oh, yeah, I played it 10 times. They always come from this direction. No, that doesn't work at all. And it keeps it fresh. The latest scenario, actually, we've done is Rendezvous with Destiny. And that's going to be sort of a flagship scenario. And it's the 101st U.S. Airborne Division making an air assault on the Russians. And that one, that took a lot of work to balance and get just right. But the guys who are playing it now, we had over 100 playtesters. Really like that. That's gotten to a nice place.
Cool.
I've got to say, I really don't have one, unfortunately, at the moment. I've not had a chance to really go through and play a lot of this, being on the heavily entrenched in documentation over the last couple of months, a lot of data work. A Time to Dance was my favorite going back into the Southern Storm days, and I definitely want to play some of these newer ones and hopefully get a chance to stream a few of these newer ones as we go kind of go forward after release. So we'll see.
So I got three more questions for you guys.
All right.
The first one, all of these are questions. These are oral defensive thesis questions for students. So you often talk about, killing your darlings or murdering your puppies or something in game design. The really cool idea is that you decide you've got to take out. So what's the idea that just didn't work, wasn't programmable, broke the game, whatever, that you regret leaving out of the game the most, even though it just never belonged there?
You're touching on so many deeply repressed memories.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to trigger a therapy session for you.
You absolutely meant to. That was the whole point of the question. You did it on purpose.
Something we wanted to do, because we have a map zoom function, and you can go from about 40%, so you see the whole map at once, and you can go past 100% to 140%. And something Jim and I really wanted to do was have the unit graphics change depending on the zoom level. So if you're fully zoomed in, you see platoons and companies, and as you start to zoom out, you see companies and battalions, say. And if you zoom all the way out, it's just a brigade marker, perhaps, something like that. And I just couldn't figure it out. And I tried a couple times. And I just the rest is history. It's not in there. I would love to do that, but I couldn't do it.
Jim, you got one, or shall I plow on to question the next?
I like that one. That's kind of, there's always a bunch of little things that never quite make it in that you would want. And there are some things that we definitely kept out of the game, and I'll go with that, which is civilians. It's a commercial game. You don't really, even though if you're playing it and you're dropping artillery on cities and this and that, there's going to be civilian casualties, but to physically have them on the map, not great for a commercial game. They're not there. So I probably would pick that. I know other people have brought, well, why don't you have them? It's like, oh, not the best thing to put in a commercial product.
It's not a game about war crimes.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's abstracted out.
Yep.
I thought you were going to say, Jim, B-52 bombers, because you put in all the military Air Force hardware. Well,
I mean, there's a ton of stuff in there, and if somebody wants to get excited, have it in there. And we got Spectre gunships, and it's expanding. The air model will in the future be a lot better and deeper. It's coming.
All right.
So your next question is, for each of you, inevitably, you're going to wind up learning a lot of things over the course of this project, over the course of 20 years, right? For each of you, what's the most important thing you've learned?
For my part, it was transitioning from a one-man band to a joint effort and giving up editorial control so that everybody owns a piece of the game and everybody has a vested interest and letting them do their thing. That was really hard to do, but you have to do it because you know a single person cannot make a war game anymore, I believe.
Jim?
Oh, I'm going to say from my side, 20 plus years of this is you can't please everybody. you know, realistically, it's you get a lot of I'll say decent input, and we kind of touched on it earlier that somebody will go, well, hey, you know, I once touched an M1 tank and this thing can put a hole through a battleship at 20 miles. It's like, oh, okay, I get it. Yes, yeah, there are certain capabilities, but we got to be bounded somewhere between, you know, your reality, the manufacturer's reality, Wikipedia reality, and our reality to make something that's a game that works. So you're not going to please everybody. Some people will like what you do. Other people will hate it. You're going to have people that are very vocal on forums. You know, you got to roll with the punches. You can't take every shot at your game personally. I learned that back with the original Red Storm with my ugly artwork for maps. as they were called ugly in at least 6 or 7 different languages. So you got to let it roll off your back and just kind of stick with the program and, you know, stick with the people around you and, you know, the inputs from people like James and Brant and, you know, other people that we've talked to and trusted for 20 years that, you know, you're on the right path and doing the right thing.
Let's be honest, though, compared to where they are now, those maps were kind of ugly.
Oh, they were hideous, but they were functional. I'll still stand by that. Yeah, those were trees, that's a river, that's ground, yeah. But yeah, they were ugly, and thank God we got William on board, and we have the beautiful maps we have today with our map team.
Well, yeah, we had a third-party map editor that made hex maps with tiles, and then you could draw in the rivers and roads and things, and it was totally functional and hugely helped us get going. And I was really disappointed that we couldn't stay with it, make it prettier, but, you know, stay with it and just tell people if you need maps, just buy a copy of this for, you know, $25 and make all you like. And instead, yeah, we went the other way and had pixel perfect maps that are just amazing now, but you have to be an image scientist basically to create it. We're working on that, by the way, but yeah, that's the hardest thing to do, creating new content. There's several people that can do it. You know, we train them and there's a map toolkit we give them and then we, you know, have a Saturday morning and get them going, but it's not for the faint of heart. I think it's fair to say.
Yeah. Cartography on its own is a skill. Converting real life cartography into, you know, game cartography is hard under the best circumstances. So.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. So for example, we're doing 1989. Well, the road net in Germany has changed enormously. And we had to go back and get the maps from 1989 to properly draw the roads and how big the urban areas were and how big the forests were. You can't just Google it and just, oh, I'm going to do an overlay and I'm done.
Still have your third?
I still have question 3. Question 3 is similar in that we're looking at the whole 20 years of this project for each of you. What's the thing that you learned about it that surprised you the most?
I guess I'll go first. And I would say almost the more things change, the more things stay the same in militaries. And being in the West, we have such a huge interest in every detail of the hardware. And then the people operating the hardware are almost an afterthought. And one of the things that I really wanted to do was bring that more into balance. And I'd read a comment by an Israeli general after the 73 war saying, yeah, the equipment was different between us and the Syrians, but we could have changed equipment stocks, you know, flipped it around, and we still would have won just the same way because it was all about the people and the leadership and the technique they had. And so I said, I'm going to model that. I'm going to do that. And boy, that's hard. There's no standard model for that. I can make stuff up, but, you know, nobody else will take it seriously. Anyway, oh, if only I could do that better. This is harder than I thought. I thought, oh, you know, model morale, readiness, training, you're done. No. It's not like that at all.
From my side of it, computer games are not board games. It's a completely different development cycle. The amount of time and effort involved, you know, the people you have to get involved. You know, I'm glad we're doing things a little faster and a little quicker than the hiatus between Red Storm and Southern Storm. And granted, there was a Mideast game and some other stuff that went on in between there that took up some time. It's been, I mean, it's always a learning experience. You know, it's something new every day. I think as computers have gotten better, the software has gotten better. The ability, I think, to communicate globally has gotten better. Now, some of that's not for the best, but yeah, we'll take what we've got. That, you know, being able to see this stuff come out of, you know, the early 2000s. And being able to talk to people and get those inputs from the internet and people saying, you know, coming over from the other side, yeah, I was a Warsaw Pact chemical officer and did this and this. And, yeah, you know, your game is, you know, got it right or wrong, and here's why. You know, great information. You know, more tools, better data. You know, we were constantly trying to improve everything. And I think that's been the biggest thing is the surprise is just, you know, all the kind of, I'll say that the information flow has just gotten bigger and bigger over time. It's just been amazing to kind of see where it started going back. I'll say, you know, from the 80s with the computers and, you know, billboards and stuff back in that day to now. It's just been an incredible journey.
All right, Jim, you once gave me some crap about harping on the Mideast game where you'd made an offhand comment and I grabbed it and ran with it for like 3 years. So when does Flashpoint Campaign's Middle East come out?
I would like to say that. I'll say this much. We've got a little block of where we're going next for the Cold War engine. And yeah, we're definitely, like we've already said here, we're trying to go to the north next. You know, pick up the Danes, the Dutch, the Swedes, the Finns, USMC, some other folks to the north. We'd like to go pick up the rest of the south so we can get things like Spain and Yugoslavia and, you know, a bunch of countries to the southern part of Europe. And penciled in there and something I showed, you know, the group in a call yesterday, is there's the Mideast block. I would love to be able to get, you know, potentially some, you know, additional people brought on board our team and content people interested in that and, you know, slowly start working to that over the next couple of years.
Okay. To be fair, I wasn't expecting a real answer. I was expecting you to give me some variation of shut up, Brant.
No, it's a place I'm sure Rob and I would both like to go back to. We definitely bit off more than we could chew when we went after it after Red Storm. Too ambitious for what was a 2 or 3 man team back then. You know, get a handful of the right content people, you know, get a couple map makers dedicated to it, you know, put it up under an evolving Cold War engine. It becomes a lot more feasible these days.
Yeah, what Jim said, the core team works on the game engine. And then we got knowledgeable contributors who say, oh, I saw your game. You know, how hard would it be to put in, you know, 1973 in the Middle East? And we've had lots of inquiries, you know, oh, how hard would it be? We know what to tell them. And if they're interested in doing it, we'll very cheerfully set them up and get them going. We're very open to that. And if people see the Cold War game and say, yeah, you know, I'd like to make some completely different content, Napoleonic, who knows? Talk to us. You know, we're easy to find. And just be aware that making war games is hard. The engine might be the hardest, but content is really hard nowadays too. And you can't just wing it and say, that's close enough, because everybody will then just jump all over you, like Jim said. Oh, I don't agree with this. I don't agree with that. And spin you around for months and years, potentially.
Yeah, but let's face it, a lot of people just disagree out of reflex.
It happens. Yeah.
So. Guys, look, I obviously, as noted at the start of this whole thing, we could go for another 2 hours easy, but okay. I have an AC/DC planning meeting that started a minute and a half ago without me, and so I need to shift over to that, and so I appreciate y'all being here. James, thank you very much for helping crash the party and you know, interrogate the guys here, so I'm
you're
glad
welcome.
You were able to join us. Rob, Jim, best of luck at, you know, all things great coming your way for the launch of Flashpoint Campaign's Cold War. We've actually had a couple of things already hit our site about it by the time people are listening to this podcast, because Peter's been hard at work with both a quick first impressions piece from the press build, but also an AAR where he's playing head-to-head with one of your playtesters and got that we've been sharing. So folks will be able to see that as well by the time this podcast goes live. So we are definitely you know, leaning hard and helping support this launch, and really hope, conversation for another day, really hope you guys are going to be able to make it back to Origins this year, because we've got some pretty snazzy stuff we're planning to do and would like to have you guys be a part of it again. So hoping you're able to make it back for that.
Oh, awesome. Thank you, Brent. It was a pleasure to be on, and James, it was a pleasure talking to you and getting the good word out.
Absolutely.
We'll try not to make it 4 years between podcast visits for the next time.
Sounds like a plan.
because, you know, you've got that Napoleonic game you're going to release next summer.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Audience, thank you all very much for joining us. We are almost done with the season. We are doing something different with the season finale. You will see the details hit social channels within the next couple of days, but expect your chance to ask us all sorts of questions as your regular podcast crew. We'll have Mike back on the show. We'll have a couple of our other regulars, and you're going to get a chance to interrogate us from afar, where we're going to take all kinds of submissions and sort of a combination AMA slash mailbag slash, you know, whatever fire hose interrogation you want to throw at us. We're going to experiment with this and see how it works. So two episodes left for this season, one of which you guys get to steer the ship. We'll catch you next time on another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches.